Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A courageous astronaut in an out-of-control spacecraft.
Nothing like it had ever been attempted before.
A brazen thief steals a priceless violin.
He left with one of the most famous instruments ever built.
And a classic board game comes to life.
The whole town is taken over by chess fever.
Inside the walls of great institutions lie extraordinary relics, tales of intrigue and wonder, and secrets waiting to be revealed. These are the mysteries at the museum. New York City. From Lincoln Center to Radio City Music Hall, the Big Apple boasts some of the most important performance venues in the country. But perhaps the most prestigious is Carnegie Hall, built in 1891 by steel magnate Andrew Carnegie. Today, its history is chronicled in a small institution on the building's eighth floor, the Archives Research Room. Its artifacts include tickets, posters, and photographs from its many famous performances. But there's one item that recalls one of Carnegie Hall's less illustrious evenings.
It is almost 80 years old. The pages have yellowed a little bit over time. It's filled with wonderful ads of upcoming concerts, cars, clothing of the day.
According to archivist Gino Francesconi, printed on this artifact are a date and name that are synonymous with one of the biggest crimes in the music world.
This was one of the most shocking events that took place in Carnegie Hall's history.
How did this esteemed music venue become the setting of an infamous theft? February 28, 1936, New York City. Famed violinist Bronislaw Uberman is about to perform a highly anticipated recital at Carnegie Hall.
Bronislaw Uberman was one of the most important and most talented violinists of his day. The concert sold out right away.
The 53-year-old Polish virtuoso is known for his expressive playing style, as well as the rich tones he's able to coax from his two violins.
Uberman owned two of the most valuable instruments of his day.
One is a Stradivarius, the other a Guarnerius, both named for the two Italian master craftsmen who built them in the late 17th and early 18th centuries.
They were considered the finest instruments of their kind. It's the fantasy of every violinist to own at least one, and he owned both of them.
As the audience takes their seats, they are given this program, the same one in the collection of the Archive Research Room. And with the performance about to begin, Uberman warms up backstage.
He had taken out the Strad, played a few notes on it, and then put it away.
He takes to the stage with his Guarnerius and leaves his Stradivarius behind. Then he gives an exemplary performance to the delight of the enraptured crowd.
The piece is over, the audience is cheering, the house lights come up.
But when Uberman returns backstage, he is shocked by what he finds. Or rather, what he doesn't find.
The Strad is missing. The Strad is gone.
The police comb Carnegie Hall, but come up empty-handed.
And they really did do a search from top to bottom, and the Strad was not found.
Soon, the case of Bronislaw Uberman's stolen Stradivarius makes nationwide headlines.
Thefts didn't occur at Carnegie Hall, as a rule. It was beyond brazen, and so this made news.
Despite the publicity, no one is able to locate the precious Stradivarius. And with no apparent hope of it ever being found, his insurance company, Lloyd's of London, pays Uberman $30,000 in compensation.
In today's dollars, that's over $500,000.
But to the devastated violinist, this is little consolation. He dies in 1947 at the age of 64.
Ubermann never found out what happened to the instrument.
The fate of Ubermann's prized Stradivarius seems destined to remain a mystery forever. But in 1987, over 50 years after it disappeared, it resurfaces in the most unlikely of hands, those of a 69-year-old Connecticut housewife.
This was shocking, to say the least.
The housewife, Marcel Hall, relates a story that stuns the music world.
This is remarkable.
According to Hall, in 1936, her husband, Julian Altman, was a struggling musician who had dreams of making it big as a classical violinist. But instead, Altman toiled away at clubs, including one on West 57th Street, in the shadow of a far more prestigious music venue.
He probably passed Carnegie Hall every day.
According to Marcel, Altman learned that the famed virtuoso Bronislaw Ubermann was set to give a recital. Altman thought a better sounding instrument could help his flagging career. And he, like many others, knew that Ubermann traveled with two prized violins. So, on the evening of the performance, Altman put on his coat, went to Carnegie Hall, and slipped backstage.
He opened the violin case and took out the Strad, put it under his coat, and left with one of the most famous instruments ever built.
Knowing this heist would be the talk of the music world for years to come, Altman devised a simple way to obscure the famously stolen fiddle.
Grime? Sweat? He didn't wipe it off. In a short period of time, the golden red color of a Strad suddenly was unrecognizable. It really looked like a cheap violin.
Altman eventually secured a place with the National Symphony Orchestra in Washington, D.C. And no one knew his secret.
He never sold the instrument. He played it his entire life. That's the attachment those instruments have on their owner. It's magical, really magical.
But on his deathbed, Julian Altman clues Marcel into his violin's true origin. And in 1987, she returns the Stradivarius to Ubermann's insurance company, Lloyd's of London. But the story doesn't end there. Ubermann's Stradivarius is put up for sale at auction. Eventually, American violinist Joshua Bell buys it in 2001 for a staggering $4 million.
The Strad itself takes on a whole new life, and it's continuing today.
And this program, in the archived research room at Carnegie Hall, commemorates a fateful 1936 performance, a stunning theft, and the incredible journey of one of the world's greatest violins. For more than 50 years, Houston, Texas has played a central role in America's quest to explore the galaxy, and its name has become synonymous with NASA's Mission Control Center itself. Today, this historic connection is celebrated at Space Center Houston. On display are nearly 250 massive relics, including a prototype of the first lunar module, a manned maneuvering unit used for spacewalks, and an enclosure for training NASA astronauts for life in the Skylab space station. But there is one object here that was almost lost in space.
It's over 9 feet high, it weighs approximately 3,000 pounds, and is suitable for only one person to fit in its compartment.
According to Education Director Dr. Melanie Johnson, this vessel served on a mission that nearly ended in tragedy.
It could have had severe consequences for one astronaut and the entire space program.
What harrowing out-of-this-world incident happened right inside this capsule? 1963, Cape Canaveral, Florida. Ever since NASA's Project Mercury sent Alan Shepard on a historic 15-minute mission to space, its manned flights have increased in length. The most recent lasted just over 9 hours. Now, in order to test the effects of a much longer trip on man, NASA wants to push the envelope even further.
NASA wants to prove that it was capable of sending a human being into orbit for at least 24 hours.
And it has the perfect man for the job. A 36-year-old astronaut and Oklahoma native named Gordon Cooper.
Gordon Cooper was known as Gordo, affectionately by his colleagues. And he was known for being cool, calm, and collected in very adverse situations.
On May 15th, Gordon Cooper confidently boards the Faith 7 capsule.
Faith 7 was ready to launch.
And at 8:04 a.m., it lifts off.
Roger, you're looking beautiful.
Faith 7 launched into orbit at 17,547 miles per hour.
Cooper settles into his routine and his mission proceeds exactly as planned. In fact, things go so well that Cooper is able to stake out a unique place in history.
He actually took a nap with a lull of the silence of space, and people claim him as the first person to sleep in space.
But at the end of his 18th orbit, Cooper notices something odd.
The spacecraft light came on, signifying re-entry. But it wasn't time for re-entry.
05G telelight came on in my telelight panel.
Cooper is convinced the light is just a faulty indicator, but his problems are only beginning. On his 20th orbit, the instruments which display his capsule's speed and orientation above the Earth stop working. Without them, he's essentially flying blind. Then Cooper notices the most troubling development of all.
The 21st orbit would be devastating. He saw a short circuit and realized that he lost power to the automatic stabilizer as well as the control system.
This system calculates the spacecraft's every maneuver to within a fraction of a second. Without it, Cooper will have to take the unprecedented step of manually piloting Faith 7 through re-entry.
Nothing like it had ever been attempted before. No one knew if he was going to be able to pull it off.
The margin for error is razor thin. If Cooper re-enters Earth's atmosphere too steeply, the G-forces will crush the astronaut. But if his trajectory is too shallow, the Faith 7 will bounce off the atmosphere and shoot back into space.
At this point, there will be no room for failure. He was noted as saying, "Things are really stacking up here."
Will Gordon Cooper survive?
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's 1963. Astronaut Gordon Cooper is in the Faith 7 capsule on a record-setting mission to test human endurance in orbit, when his navigation system suddenly fails. Now Cooper must attempt something unprecedented, a manual re-entry into Earth's atmosphere. There is zero room for error. So can this courageous space cowboy make it home?
With his equipment down, Cooper needs some way to determine his position relative to the Earth. So the cool-headed pilot thinks of an ingenious solution.
He drew on the window in the fog a line that lined up with the horizon based on the constellation so that he can reorient himself.
and that's just the first step. Now Cooper must perform a series of precisely timed rocket thrusts. With the assistance of his colleague, John Glenn, at Mission Control, the astronaut uses his own wristwatch to time each one perfectly.
4, 3, 2, 1, fire. Roger, green on air. Drill 5, it looks like they came off right on the money on time.
Roger, I think so.
As Faith 7 makes the intense passage through the atmosphere, it disappears from radio contact. For several long minutes, no one on the ground knows if Cooper is alive. Then, the crew of a Navy ship positioned in the Pacific Ocean spots a tiny white parachute in the sky. Incredibly, Faith 7 lands just 4 miles from the recovery ship. And when the crew retrieves the capsule, there's good news.
Doors opened and out came Gordon Cooper.
Cooper's mission lasted an astonishing 34 hours, 19 minutes, and 49 seconds in space, longer than all 5 previous Mercury missions combined. And his incredible story of courage under pressure makes him a national hero.
Gordon Cooper was celebrated from Washington to his hometown in Oklahoma and was provided the largest ticker tape parade in New York City.
Today, Gordon Cooper's Faith 7 capsule is on display at Space Center Houston. It serves as a testament to one astronaut's heroic exploits in the face of unimaginable adversity. Seattle, Washington is home to over 20 museums and more than 100 art galleries. But visitors who want to experience art of a moving variety head to the region's premier cinematic center, the Northwest Film Forum. Founded in 1995, this institution maintains a vault of over 1,000 titles and screens hundreds of films each year. And while many merit celebration, one movie in particular stands out for blurring the lines between fact and fiction.
There's an image on it of 2 men raising their arms, and they're standing in a field of grass, and behind them, it looks like there's a rainbow.
According to programming director Courtney Sheehan, when the real-life events captured on this disc came to light, it sparked a national controversy.
People were surprised and shocked.
What bizarre stunt is captured on this DVD? 2003, the Czech Republic. 13 years after leaving the Soviet Union, the Czech people have embraced capitalism. While many citizens still recall the strict rationing under communism, shoppers now crowd into stores for the chance to get their hands on Western products. And riding this wave are new big-box stores called hypermarkets.
The hypermarket had just about anything that you could want. You could buy a television, you could buy steak, you could buy beer.
That spring, the capital city of Prague is saturated with colorful posters announcing the city's newest and biggest hypermarket. It's called Český Sen, or Czech Dream.
The ads were very sleek and colorful.
The campaign announces that the new market will open in the city's fairgrounds that May, and tantalizes residents with the lowest prices anywhere in Europe or even America.
You could buy a TV for just $20 and beer for as cheap as 10 cents.
As more ads continue to plaster Prague, anticipation reaches a fever pitch.
People were very excited.
Finally, on May 31st, opening day arrives. That morning, people start trickling into the fairgrounds. And before them is a truly remarkable sight. The colossal storefront of Czech Dream looms on the horizon like a vibrantly colored temple to bargain shopping.
The front of the store was massive and had a big rainbow painted on it.
Soon, the crowd balloons to over 4,000 excited shoppers.
The turnout was incredible.
Finally, two men greet the assembled masses and introduce themselves as the managers of Czech Dream. Then they cut a ceremonial ribbon and open the gates, sending a wave of fervent shoppers towards the store.
They're so excited that many of them are actually running.
But as the crowd approaches the gigantic storefront, their excitement gives way to utter astonishment.
They realize that, in fact, there's nothing there. It's just a facade held up by scaffolding, and there's no store behind it.
The so-called hypermarket is nothing more than a giant billboard, 30 feet high and 300 feet long.
This had to be some kind of prank.
But the betrayed crowd is not amused. And they demand answers from the two alleged managers of the store. The two men make a stunning revelation.
They're not retailers and they don't work with hypermarkets. They're actually student filmmakers.
They identify themselves as Vít Klusák and Philippe Ramunda and explain their real motivation for the elaborate stunt. They are actually making a documentary about the manipulative power of advertising.
They really wanted to expose some absurdities that they were noticing in Czech society.
They point out that the prices in the Czech Dream ads were clearly too good to be true. A fact the people of Prague could have easily realized, if only they had not been caught up in a frenzy.
The filmmaker said that people were blindly consumers without really questioning it on a deeper level.
Vít and Philippe wanted to show how people could be convinced of anything, however implausible, as long as it was given the proper spin. And to pull it off, the industrious filmmakers enlisted some of the city's premier marketing talent.
The advertising campaign was incredibly effective.
In 2004, the documentary Czech Dream is released to critical acclaim and earns top marks at festivals across the globe. It's eventually distributed to international audiences on DVD, including the copy now part of the collection of the Northwest Film Forum in Seattle. Today, it's a vivid statement about the incredible lore of a good bargain. Marostica, Italy sits in the majestic foothills of the Asiago Mountains. This castle-topped village is surrounded by stunning views. Yet storybook scenery isn't Marostica's only draw.
So this small Italian town is home to one of the strangest traditions in Europe, and it attracts so many tourists.
This unusual tradition is a living chess game, dramatically played out by actors dressed as chess pieces on the town's checkered piazza. And inside this medieval castle is a place that celebrates this amazing spectacle, the Museum of the Human Chess Game Customs. According to Professor Kate Williams, among the garments worn by bishops, queens, and kings is a dress that embodies the life-sized game's legendary prize.
It's very feminine. It's made of cream cloth with a green brocade on top and gold trim, and it's accentuated with incredible embellishments of emerald and pearls. It represents a fascinating tale of royalty, romance, and strategy.
How is this dress linked to one of Europe's most curious customs? 1454, Marostica. This idyllic Italian town is led by a beloved ruler, Lord Taddeo Parizio.
Taddeo Parizio, he was incredibly respected. He loves the arts, he wants to keep the peace, and he's also a very good community leader as well.
But Lord Parizio holds one role more dear than any other, looking after his teenage daughters, Leonora and Oldrada.
He's an adoring father. What he wants is them to be married to men who are going to look after them, who are going to adore them too.
The two girls are reputed for their charm and grace. But the eldest, Leonora, is said to be the fairest maiden in the land.
Leonora is incredibly beautiful. So beautiful, the tale says that the angels were jealous of her amazing beauty.
And her good looks stir a heated rivalry among two of Lord Parizio's most trusted knights, Rinaldo and Vieri.
Both of them are passionately in love with Leonora. They are absolutely, both of them, determined to have her. Normally, two knights would duel for her hand, fight to the death. The one who wins gets the girl.
But the enlightened Lord Parizio abhors violence and will not allow one of his loyal knights to die over such a dispute. Instead, he tells them that the matter will be decided in a battle not of swords, but of wits.
The battle Lord Parizio suggests is a game of chess. The winner receives beautiful Leonora as a wife. But the loser also has a prize. He gets the younger sister, Oldrada.
News of the unusual contest quickly becomes the talk of Marustica.
The whole town is taken over by chess fever.
But along with the excitement, Leonora quietly admits something that causes gossip to swirl.
Leonora is actually already in love with one of the men, but she won't say who it is.
All the beautiful princess will say is that she will reveal her true feelings after the match is over.
If the man she wanted to win won, she would put a candle in her window.
Finally, the day of the match arrives. As the nervous daughters look on, Rinaldo and Vieri anxiously face off across the board.
The game that will change their lives is being played out in front of them.
As soon as the match begins, Rinaldo jumps to an early lead.
It really seems like he's the stronger player.
Yet just when Vieri looks defeated, he boldly goes on the attack.
Vieri makes this amazing comeback, and he absolutely corners Rinaldo's king. And he's declared the winner.
Leonora graciously takes the hand of Vieri, her newly betrothed. Yet her face betrays no emotion about the match's outcome. And the people of Marostica can only wait in anticipation for her true feelings to be revealed.
And legend has it that night, as the sun went down, a candle appeared in Leonora's window, and that candle showed that Vieri was the man she loved.
As the story goes, Leonora weds Vieri, Oldrada weds Rinaldo, and everyone lives happily ever after. But though historical records of the event end there, the legend of the chess match is just beginning. Over the years, the charming tale becomes embedded in local folklore. And in 1923, an art student breathes new life into this centuries-old chess match. His name is Mirko Vucetic.
He heard the story about this legend and actually decided to put on a play.
Captivated by the drama of this unusual contest, Vucetic decides to stage it on a massive board, using actors as chess pieces. The play is a smash.
And after that, people thought, this is marvelous, let's do it again. Every 2 years, the giant chess match is staged in the middle of the piazza, and 500 people take part, dressed up as pawns and knights and castles. It's a bit like Alice in Wonderland.
This spectacle even includes people dressed as Lord Parizio, his knights, and daughters, with one woman wearing this Leonora dress, now on display at the Museum of the Human Chess Game Customs. The event proves so popular that eventually Marostica's piazza is redesigned to resemble a giant chessboard. And tourists flock to the town to see the spectacle for themselves.
Marostica becomes known as the city of chess.
Today, this tradition celebrates the triumph of brains over brawn and the enduring tale that made this lesson come alive. St. Paul, Minnesota. In 1841, a Catholic minister established a chapel here in honor of his favorite saint, Paul the Apostle. The name stuck, and the city that grew around it became the territory's capital just 8 years later. And today, one institution celebrates the culture of the North Star State, the Minnesota History Center. Its eclectic collection features a 36-foot fur trader's canoe, an interactive exhibit on the 1950s baby boom, and a prize belt from a local wrestling champion. But one item in the archives strikes a more musical note.
The artifact is about 2 feet wide and nearly as tall. It has keys on one side with push buttons on another, and it releases a lovely sound.
According to associate curator Sandra Ryerson, This instrument was played by a spirited and trailblazing American leader. But a shocking revelation caused her meteoric rise to fame to come crashing down.
This sort of scandal was unprecedented in American politics.
Who owned this accordion, and what surprising secret led to her undoing? Oakley, Minnesota, 1942. Koya Knutson works hard to keep up with work and chores. But with her husband, Andy, struggling with alcoholism, she finds herself trapped. Thankfully, Koya finds escape in a longtime passion, music.
Music was always important for Koya. She sang and played piano, guitar, and the accordion.
That June, she is mesmerized by a completely new sound. The voice of First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt.
One day, Koya is listening to the radio. Eleanor is encouraging women to get involved in politics.
Though American women first gained the right to vote 20 years earlier, relatively few have sought or held public office since. Inspired by the First Lady's appeal, Koya joins her local Democratic Party. She volunteers her time to help fight for the interests of area farmers.
She finds that she's truly interested in politics.
Koya's enthusiasm only grows. So in 1950, when a seat opens up in the state legislature, she seizes the opportunity. Koya runs for office and wins handily, becoming one of just two women elected to the Minnesota House. But she soon feels she can accomplish even more. In 1954, the politician stuns the local establishment by announcing a run for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives.
She wanted to go to Washington.
But this will be no easy task. Minnesota has never sent a woman to Congress. And her ambition runs afoul of state Democratic Party bosses, who think that Koya is moving too fast.
They are adamant that they would not support her. She was told that she needed to retain her seat in the Minnesota House. And so she ignored them and ran a grassroots campaign of her own.
Koya Knutson grabs her trusty accordion, the same instrument now at the Minnesota History Center, and hits the campaign trail. There, the candidate's two passions, music and politics, fall into perfect harmony. She charms voters across Minnesota with polka songs and rousing stump speeches.
Music was always an important way for Koya to connect with her constituents.
That November, she wins an historic victory against her Republican opponent.
Koya is the first woman to be elected to the U.S. Congress from Minnesota and from the Midwest.
Koya relocates to Washington and snags a place on the influential House Agricultural Committee. There, she champions family farmers like the ones she got to know in Minnesota. And when she's reelected in 1956, it seems like there's no stopping the ambitious former farm wife.
It looked like she had a long career ahead of her.
But then, in 1958, as she's running for her third term, something happens that upends her political career. A bizarre letter appears in newspapers in Washington and Minnesota, and it's from none other than her estranged husband.
Koya's husband, Andy, releases a statement which implies that Koya is having an affair, and he asks Koya to leave politics and come home.
Soon the phrase, "Koya, come home," echoes in headlines from coast to coast.
There were plenty of people who agreed with Andy that a woman's place is in her home.
Koya refuses to dignify the accusations with a response. Yet conservative voters find the scandalous claim of infidelity impossible to ignore.
Her reputation was tarnished immediately, and her supporters began to flee.
Koya loses her election by over 1,000 votes and returns to Minnesota. But when she confronts her estranged husband, he makes a shocking confession.
Andy reveals to Koya that he did not write the letter.
Andy explains that Koya's former party colleagues were behind the whole plot. It emerges that Democratic bosses were fuming over Koya's refusal to toe the party line when she was a state legislator.
Koya always put her constituents ahead of the party, and that did not sit well with party leaders.
So they drafted the letter and strong-armed Andy into going along with it. In light of this revelation, Coya petitions the House to review the validity of the election results. But the Congressional Committee concludes the matter is outside their jurisdiction.
Coya was completely crushed.
Coya finally divorces Andy. Yet even though her days in elected office are over, she is eventually appointed by President John F. Kennedy as a liaison for the Office of Civil Defense at the Pentagon. Today, her accordion is on display at the Minnesota History Center, where it serves as a tribute to a trailblazing woman whose people-first politics put her ahead of her time. San Francisco. The U.S. government opened a mint here in 1854 to accommodate the throngs of miners who flooded Northern California during the famed gold rush. The city has been a center of finance ever since. And one part of that history is on display here at the Bank of America Heritage Center. Its collection includes a bank vault from the 1880s and an original cable from the Golden Gate Bridge, which the bank helped finance. But amid these prized items is one that appears to have no value at all.
This artifact is about 6 inches long, 4 inches wide, and it is charred black.
According to archivist David Mendoza, this burned relic tells the story of a heroic figure who helped save the city.
It symbolizes the convictions of one man to help people who had suffered from a catastrophe to rebuild.
How did a natural disaster give rise to one of America's largest financial institutions? San Francisco, 1904. Entrepreneur Amedeo Peter Giannini is a second-generation Italian-American with deep ties to his local community.
Everybody knew him and called him AP.
After a successful career in the produce business, the 34-year-old Giannini is now focused on helping his fellow citizens invest their money.
Banks at the time really catered to the wealthy in San Francisco. He wanted everybody to prosper.
With the working class essentially shut out of financial institutions, many people became accustomed to storing their life savings under a mattress.
Giannini really believed that they should put their money in the bank.
Giannini founds the Bank of Italy in a building on the corner of Montgomery Avenue and Washington Street in downtown San Francisco. Before long, members of the city's immigrant community flock to Giannini's headquarters to deposit their hard-earned savings. But in 1906, things take a seismic change for the worse. On the morning of April 18th, Giannini is fast asleep at his home in San Mateo, 17 miles from San Francisco. Suddenly, he is awakened by an almighty tremor.
The jolt was so powerful, it knocked him out of his sleep.
Knowing there's been an earthquake, Giannini's first concern is his business. If the disaster has destroyed his headquarters, his customers' life savings could be wiped out.
His thoughts were not only on the bank, but of all the people who had entrusted him with their money.
Giannini has to get to his bank, and fast. But with railways destroyed by the quake, he has no choice but to make a grueling trek to San Francisco by foot.
AP sees destruction everywhere. People are fleeing, houses and buildings are toppled. It's basically a scene of a disaster.
Amazingly, when Giannini finally reaches his bank's headquarters, the building is still standing. But his relief soon turns to dread. Just blocks away, a massive fire, a mile long, is consuming everything in its path.
He knew that it was time to close up shop and take everything out and leave.
He quickly unloads the contents of his bank safe.
He has $80,000 in cash and gold, which in today's terms would be a little over $2 million.
But outside, the havoc wrought by the earthquake and fire creates another serious threat.
Some people began to loot stores. Chaos is everywhere. He knows he needs to leave with the bank's valuables.
The resourceful Giannini poses as a displaced earthquake victim. He then loads his customer savings onto a cart he procures from a neighboring business.
He hides the money on fruit carts and covers them with blankets.
As night falls, he carefully leaves the city with his customers' money. After a tense few hours, Giannini arrives at his home in San Mateo unharmed, and it seems he's made it just in time. The earthquake and the fires that swept across San Francisco destroyed over 80% of the city, including the downtown headquarters of Giannini's business.
The Bank of Italy, it's basically a pile of rubble burned to the ground.
As a memento of that fateful day, a piece of charred wood, the same one now on display at the Heritage Center, is salvaged from the ruins. In the wake of the disaster, many of the city's financial institutions are destroyed, their assets incinerated. But Giannini's heroic efforts allow him to assist his customers almost instantly.
He opens a temporary office. It was basically a plank of wood that he found and set up two barrels to make a desk and immediately started loaning money.
A.P. Giannini plays a pivotal role in helping San Francisco rebuild. His business goes on to become one of the biggest banks in California and eventually gets a new name to reflect its wider appeal.
In 1930, A.P. Giannini decided to change the name of Bank of Italy to Bank of America. By 1945, it actually became the largest bank in the world.
Today, this piece of charred wood, the last surviving remnant of Giannini's original San Francisco headquarters, pays tribute to one heroic man and the humble beginnings of one of America's biggest banks. From a stolen Strad to a retail ruse, a battle of the wits to a fall from space.
I'm Don Wildman, and these are the mysteries at the museum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.